What's up, everybody? How are you doing? Welcome to the Organic Guy podcast. I am your host, the Organic Guy. This is your home of organic conversations where you get to hear from various thought leaders across the organic movement. And today I am super, super excited to be joined by Kelly Grayson, also known as Glyphosate Girl. She's an independent public health advocate. She holds an MBA from Stanford Graduate School of Business. She has worked in investment banking and private equity. And right now I can pretty much say that she is on a mission to help eradicate glyphosate and other dangerous chemicals from our lives. As a creative and a creator of our content, I'm a huge admirer of her work, especially the creativity that goes in producing the kind of content that she does, in making very easy to be digestible by anybody that comes across her content. So, Miss Kelly, thank you very much for joining me in the podcast.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for such nice words.
Yeah, a pleasure. You know, I always like to give, you know, the viewers and the listeners a little bit of background. In your case, you can sort of take us back to your childhood, right? I'm talking about 7, 8, 9 years old. So if we were to go by and ask, you know, your friends, what would they say about you, especially from a personality point? So were you sort of the quieter child, or were you the outspoken child?
So I was actually a very, very shy child. Not excruciatingly shy, but, you know, just quiet. I enjoyed, you know, reading. I really enjoyed school and enjoyed sports. I grew up in a town called San Mateo in California, and it was before the area turned into Silicon Valley. And so it was a much quieter area, not the land of the uber wealthy, just more people that were, you know, educated, interesting, and there was more of an art scene at the time. So I grew up in that environment, and my dad was in the Air Force, so he was gone most weekends up at Travis Air Force Base flying. So I grew up very patriotic as well, I guess I should say.
So it's fair to say that you couldn't have seen yourself becoming an activist.
I really couldn't. In fact, I think up until I started doing this, activist carried a really negative connotation to me. I think particularly because my background being in business and in finance, my major was economics. I led a very mainstream kind of life. And I frankly kind of thought activists, you know, this is terrible because I am one, but maybe we're a little overly emotional, or maybe just like so high, or like, you know, off on psychedelics, which may be part of the thing now, but there's certainly a lot more than that too. And we just owe so much to what so many activists have done. So no, I couldn't have seen myself going this direction at all.
I do see your point in terms of like activists do have this kind of negative connotation, especially when you look from an environmental point of view and, you know, some of the activists that happens in that space.
Yeah, sometimes, like, you know, when people are like, oh, what do? Like, describe yourself. And I mean, quite literally, I am an activist. I mean, that is what it is. But I'm hesitant to use that word just because of my own preconceived notions of it.
You know, when you look at your background, it's very much business oriented, investment banking and private equity. Good amount of money, I guess, you know, from the outside looking in. So what made you, you know, change from that space into activism space? And what I'm trying to ask you is, like, what was that epiphany moment? You know, the Isaac Newton sitting in an apple tree and then the apple falls and even it's like, gravitational force here. So what was your process in terms of saying, you know what, now forward, I just want to be referred as Glyphosate Girl?
So I unfortunately really had to take a step back career-wise, because I was impacted with just a lot of health issues just all of a sudden. And I'm someone that always kind of had stomach problems, but, you know, nothing that really flagged any major problem. It seems like most people have stomach problems these days. But what started happening to me was more neurological, and I was just having so many weird symptoms. Like, my eyesight was kind of starting to go. I couldn't really feel my hands and my legs, and sometimes they'd just go numb, and I'd have strange rashes. And you take that to any Western doctor and they're going to be like, I mean, I have no idea, except here are a lot of drugs, you know. So I was trying drugs to try and make these things go away. And interestingly, and not surprising probably to many listeners, the conclusion was often that I had a psychiatric illness, because I was imagining all these things happening to me physically that were not perceivable on standard medical tests at the time, and actually still to this day, it's like, you can't just, my blood tests all looked great, you know, and like I went in for an MRI and I didn't have MS or whatever it was. And fortunately, I eventually came to the conclusion that I had a problem with gluten. And when I went gluten-free, a lot of my symptoms started lightening up and I started taking vitamins and sort of just fully rehabilitating myself. And it was around then that I realized that our grains, I was like, well, why gluten? Why gluten? And I realized, okay, our grains, and actually not just grains, but a lot of our foods, at least in the US, are sprayed with Roundup to facilitate an easier harvest. So it's called pre-harvest desiccation. It dries out the crops and then they can harvest them much faster. So when I realized this, I started digging even farther and farther. And at the time, and this was probably six years ago, only 5 years ago, that a light started going off in my head. And it was at a very weird cuspy kind of time where the idea of gluten sensitivity was still sitting in the category of it being just like a trendy diet from Hollywood. And so, you know, someone that just like wants to be skinny or, you know, whatever it is. And it ended up being so much more than that, but the published research really wasn't all that substantial on non-celiac gluten sensitivity. And certainly there was very, very little research on the Roundup front. And the research that there was on the connection between gluten sensitivity and Roundup use was by Dr. Stephanie Senna and Anthony Sansel. And they had just been reamed like online for being poor scientists and like, what do they know? Conspiracy theorists, like all this stuff. And so at the time, I didn't understand that like Monsanto Bayer would be interested in like completely defaming them. So I was like, oh, well, maybe they don't know what they're talking about, because I didn't understand how deep kind of it goes in terms of the PR protecting this chemical. So around that time, I was just researching Monsanto, and I realized that the Monsanto cancer trials were starting in San Francisco with Lee Johnson, who was a pesticide applicator and still is. Well, he's not a pesticide applicator anymore, but he's still with us, and claiming that Roundup caused his cancer. And so I went up to the courthouse just curious about it. And I actually was going to protest Monsanto, because I assumed, because of San Francisco, which historically has been an enormous place of activism, that people would be out there just really PO'd. And so I got up there and there was no one there. And this trial was a huge deal, because it's the first time Monsanto had been put in front of a trial of a jury, for a jury to decide, did Monsanto lie? Did they know that this causes cancer? And I walked right in, sat right with the lawyers, and I was like, oh my goodness, not many people are covering this at all. So I named myself Glyphosate Girl and started a blog where I would blog every single day that goings on in the courtroom, just to be sure that these like little sneaky things that Monsanto, the agricultural chemical industry, do like somehow get out to the mass public, and hopefully in an entertaining way. So that's when I made myself Glyphosate Girl. And now I haven't looked back. Now I guess I'm that activist. I'm actually, frankly, like, I'm back to my business school reunions, and I'm seeing all these people working in health, in healthcare. And I mean, it's amazing, because you do need to solve the problems that are being created right there. I mean, thank goodness for a lot of cures that are out there, but I'm like, no, don't you realize, if you just went to the source, if you changed the food system and didn't have people impacted, not just with glyphosate, but with all these pesticides, you wouldn't need all of that. But like, people look at me blankly, because it's just not on the map of most people thinking that that could possibly be a thing. Which, don't you just find that so interesting? Just that, you know, the presumption that our body will adapt to whatever we're exposed to and we'll be fine.
I've come to realize it's more of a paradigm. It's just how you view the world makes a huge difference on how you understand facts, how you look at facts when they're presented to you. So if you have a paradigm like, you know what, I can get a pill to sort of reduce my glyphosate intake, you know, that's the path you're going to take. And if you have a different path, you know what, why should we, you know, wait to have a pill in order to deal with these problems, while we can just, you know, get rid of it? So it's about paradigms. What thing resonates with you most? And that's the path that you're going to follow.
Yeah. If people that are interested in public health really wanted to make a big impact, and I mean this to, and I don't know how many college students you have listening to your podcast, but I'm thinking college students and high school students in particular, if you are interested in public health and you are starting to study and you're studying it academically, I think that the single best thing that you could do to improve public health is to stop the exposure to these chemicals. else. I mean, it just, can you imagine, and particularly all these underserved communities, I mean, just by cleaning their food, it would be such a massive improvement. It just seems so obvious to me.
It's the same thing in college, actually. So once you come into college, I mean, their paradigm is that of chemicals. So for example, one of the things that you know, if you're taking agriculture, one of the things that gets pounded in your heads that you have to use fake fertilizers, for example. You have to use these pesticides in order to grow your crops. So imagine 4 years of those reinforcement of, hey, you need this for you to, you know, be a better farmer. You need this to be a better agricultural extensionist. So you get that energy and information pounded in your head. When you look the other way, you actually start doubting yourself. You know, am I actually insane? Am I sane? I mean, a lot of people are going this way. Why should I go this way? So it's about that paradigm and get what gets pushed into your head as well. You know, it's a very interesting path that you've taken. And, you know, for someone who doesn't know what glyphosate is, you know, can you help us expound, like, what is this thing called glyphosate?
Yeah. So glyphosate is the active ingredient in the weed killer Roundup, and it's the most widely used herbicide in history. And it is extremely effective as a weed killer. And originally when it came out, people were thrilled because they said, oh, this doesn't impact the human at all, because the mechanism in which glyphosate works, they were claiming, is only in plants and not in humans. You know, over the last 50 years, and certainly post-World War II, there was sort of a divergence of thought, and really started, you could really see a separation of nature from human as being two different things. So, you know, if it were to impact a plant, why would it impact me? And so that kind of became a common thought. Now we very much know from all the research and frankly common sense that glyphosate does impact humans as well, and it causes cancer, and very specifically goes in, and parts of our microbiome have that same pathway that the plants have. And so what kills the plants also kills a lot of our beneficial bacteria in our microbiome. And in fact, not only does it kill the beneficial bacteria, but it also potentiates some of the bad bacteria in the biome. So what is often still touted as being safe enough to drink, glyphosate is truly anything but.
Yeah, we could look at the history of, you know, these chemicals have become to be widely used from, you mentioned the World Wars, the Monsanto's actually supplying the US government these chemicals to go slash forests in Vietnam so that they could see the military and so that they can kill them easily. So when you look at the history of how we've used these chemicals, it's just horrendous.
And with glyphosate, it's also, it was first used as a boiler cleaner because it chelates. It can clean metals, heavy metals, out of pipes back in the day. And they realized, okay, we could also use this as a weed killer. But what it also does is chelates the different minerals in the soil. And then when the crops are grown, the minerals aren't bioavailable to the crop. So all of the things that you're eating, you know, non-organically don't have the same nutrient levels that they would have prior to the use of glyphosate. And I mean, I just, like, a lot of times think, and that includes magnesium, and there's a huge, huge magnesium deficiency problem in this country, and actually zinc too. And most people that would go and test for magnesium levels would find themselves deficient. And that is our relaxation mineral. So, you know, what would happen if we actually had the correct amount of magnesium? Just think, all these emotions would just slowly start decreasing.
Definitely. I mean, there are a lot of things that glyphosate does negatively. I mean, from biodiversity loss to cancers to everything in between. You know, when I was reading your story, one of the major effects that you actually affected you personally was how glyphosate affects your gut health. So this is like a very intimate story and something that you've gone through. So can you sort of give us through your journey and your story on, you know, what was the effect and how does it actually affect your gut health?
So eventually, when I kept on testing and testing for various things, one thing that did pop up was an autoimmunity marker in my blood work. And I was surprised. I don't really know much about autoimmunity, except that there's a huge explosion in autoimmune conditions in this country, and actually I think in most Western countries. Autoimmunity being that the body starts attacking itself. And functional medicine really focused on what is it about the gut and what is it about the integrity of the gut lining that is so critical to our health and often not detected, frankly, by like most Western medicine. And something that we know that glyphosate does, other toxins can do it too, but this is the most obvious one that we're all exposed to in our diet all the time, is cause something called leaky gut or gut dysbiosis. What happens, and I know this is the case with me and many other people, that it seems to be predominantly women that I see dealing with the autoimmune conditions, but once you realize what's happening, it's really appalling. So the integrity of your gut lining can really be messed up and effectively let toxins out of the intestine and into the bloodstream when they never should have gotten bloodstream in the first place. These chemicals like glyphosate and frankly the POEA, which is the surfactant, which is another component of the Roundup formulation, and that surfactant is a soapy substance that allows the glyphosate to better penetrate into a leaf when it's sprayed. And you think, okay, so then you're consuming this. Where is that going? What is that doing to the human cell, right? Like, what's that doing to your gut line? And it all really makes sense that little holes are being made in our gut and the toxins are leaking into our bloodstream. So that's when, you know, my body started attacking itself. And by eating organically and then taking probiotics and trying to revamp and you know, fermented foods and all those things that we hear about and from the functional world, I was really able to heal it. Although occasionally if I slip up, I can feel the autoimmunity kind of creeping back in. If I go on a bender and have a week of, you know, eating things I probably shouldn't, I feel it creep back in. I'm like, oh man. But what was interesting is that, and very frustrating to me, is the Institute of Functional Medicine. I consider it sort of the leader in collecting and organizing functional medicine research and doctors. And there's a great training program that's there to teach people, okay, this is another approach to medicine and it's really root cause based. And a lot of times, and almost always, it comes back to the gut, actually. What's very frustrating to me is that that organization has every opportunity to be saying, oh, and here, they'll say pesticides also impact. They will never say it's Roundup and glyphosate, ever. And it makes me nuts. I'm like, obviously. And I've asked the scientists and doctors one-on-one, they're like, oh yeah, you know, but they can't talk about it because their research will be pulled or they won't get funding and they're really hidden to talk about it. So the Institute doesn't talk about it, which is a big missed opportunity. But if you talk to most functional doctors, they're like, oh yeah, glyphosate. They know.
And that's the frustrating thing about it, actually. When you go to Wikipedia, for example, to try and read about glyphosate and, you know, some of the effects, you can't believe what's in there. I mean, some of the things that they quote is just crazy. So you can't find any research that shows, for example, the negative effects of glyphosate. And if you just go to, you know, published scientific journals, you'll find a lot of this research. But then the other thing that is corny about them is the wording. So they use like scientific consensus on glyphosate. So the wording is great from their part, but if you know, just a regular guy trying to get more knowledge about glyphosate, you'll totally be screwed in terms of like knowing what's going on.
The truth has no chance of learning. Yeah. I think if the average guy hears you and me talking about this and they go look it up, they're gonna be like, oh, those people are crazy. It's fine. Look, the EPA says it's fine, right? EFSA says it's fine. And these paid scientists who, you know, Monsanto paid to ghostwrite research for them, they say it's fine.
So it's just totally confusing. And, you know, I remember the first time I came in contact with glyphosate, I think it was around 2018. So I just finished my bachelor's and I was very much getting into organic. So I was very passionate about organic. I just read some articles online about organic. And in my mind, it felt very similar because I grew up in an environment where, you know, agriculture was done and use any chemicals and this kind of stuff. So it was around this time I was learning about the use of toxic chemicals in farming and the effect of glyphosate and this kind of stuff. So I remember the first time I came in contact with glyphosate was the case of Dwayne Johnson and Monsanto. Yeah, I was reading, you know, some of your work. You know, you were actually in the courtroom of this case. So can you sort of take us through, you know, what was your experience being in that courtroom?
It was just really something because you can imagine who the Monsanto lawyers are. I mean, they are experts at what they do. The lead lawyer on the Monsanto side had also defended big tobacco and pharma. So he had an amazing track record. So I'm certain that Monsanto thought, okay, we're sending in like our A++ team. And, you know, his opening statements were, you know, the EPA, why wouldn't you trust the EPA? They wouldn't approve something. They're very serious scientists protecting our health. And it was just fascinating to see that argument be torn apart little by little. And a lot of those days were super, super boring because really arguing research piece by research piece. I mean, and like, what were the stats on that one? What, you know, are the specific, just really minutiae scientific paper and research. But I really loved it because the scientists, there were scientists themselves there, like talking about it on both sides. I had both, I mean, being able to sit almost as if I'm a juror and see what are the arguments on both sides about whether or not this causes cancer is pretty amazing. And the lawyer that was on Lee Johnson's side, his name's Brent Wisner, and he was just such a joy to watch argue because he's just a really talented litigator who really feels things very deeply on the subject, and as does his boss, Michael Baum. And it really made it fun for me to write about, because I'm like, it's the kind of thing you would almost see in like Law and Order where they propose something preposterous and it's just shot down really effectively. So that part was really exciting. But what was so depressing at the same time was just seeing the extent to which the regulators are fully captured by these companies. So Bayer getting in there, Monsanto, now Bayer, Bayer acquired Monsanto, so I kind of use them interchangeably, in there, like working constantly with their regulatory relations person. And very, very clearly, the decisions are being made based off of that relationship and the money involved. And certainly not what the science says. The EPA repeatedly rejected even the idea that this could possibly cause cancer. And when IARC, the decision came out and they said this is a probable human carcinogen, I mean, Monsanto freaked out. The EPA had Monsanto's back and they're like, we're not gonna, you know, let this happen. I mean, just so corrupt. Our regulators are so, so corrupt. And I feel really bad for the people that work at the EPA that know this, but they're stuck if they want to keep a job and they just have to be okay with it.
You know, it's never easy, especially now if you take Monsanto's shoes. I mean, their aim is to protect their product as much as possible, right? And that's where the EPA is supposed to come in and say, you know what, this is not supposed to happen. But now if they go into bed with these corporations, then doesn't make sense.
No, there is no catch. And, you know, interestingly, recently, federal court ordered the EPA to reassess their human health evaluation of glyphosate because the evidence had been presented. Oh, my gosh, they're not doing their job. Like, here's to cause cancer. How come you, EPA, keep on coming out and saying there's no evidence that it causes cancer when here it all is? So this court finally said, OK, by October 1st, we want to see you redo your human health assessment. Then just a couple weeks ago, the EPA came back and said, we couldn't possibly do it. That would be too much work for us to do. Like in a short period of time, but it's all there. Like, that's a lie. I mean, it blows my mind. And so then my question always is, okay, so then what happens then if the EPA is not going to do it? Like, does the court send the military in? Like, who can make them do this? I'm not even sure that we have someone that can. I know that a lot of the senators, even some of the people that are on the agricultural committee, have no idea the extent of the glyphosate Roundup problem. I mean, they just don't even know. They don't have time to know. So my feeling recently has been if some of those senators and congresspeople could know, then I think that there'd be more pressure because who wants to be eating this? I mean, so many people have medical problems. So.
Yeah. And I think I saw your post, I think on Instagram, talking about Germany is sort of trying to phase out glyphosate by 2024. And, you know, your question was, why isn't the U.S. doing this?
Yeah, given that Bayer is a German company and they are phasing it out, it's very confusing.
Yeah, so this actually leads me to my next question of, does activism work? I mean, we've talked about how frustrating it can be in terms of trying to get your ideas across because there are a lot of people who have different intentions on what they're trying to achieve.
So I really go back and forth on this because I feel like I've been working at this pretty hard for 4 years and I see little signs of hope here and there when there are little small breakthroughs. On a small level, I do see, you know, just in my town, alone. You know, I've been talking about it enough that we aren't using as much Roundup, and certainly my neighbors aren't using as much Roundup. And so I try and calculate it like, okay, that means that the dogs that are walking down my street are no longer absorbing it up through their little paws, and they're less likely to get lymphoma. I think that over the next 5 years or so, we're going to see another explosion in people starting to understand this, just as people get sick. So my hope is that as people start to realize that this explosion in chronic illness is weird, frankly, and shouldn't be acceptable, and I think, like, you know, COVID, for better or worse, has refocused people on health and what the government does or doesn't do. And even to the point of in agriculture, people starting to grow their own gardens and wanting, you know, farmers things. I see a trend going that direction because I think enough people are going to be sick that they're going to want to feel better. And my hope is that the activists like us will be there already with the knowledge that can help them understand. So unlike us going to Wikipedia and seeing all this stuff from the other side, that there'll be other alternatives that people can go to and start to better understand it. But I think things like, you know, this podcast, podcast if people want to learn about it. I think those are such excellent steps because each day someone's eyes are waking up to it. I had someone post on my Instagram like, oh, where can I see the ingredient list to see if glyphosate's in the things that we're buying? And of course, they don't have to list pesticides, which is so interesting, really. But you know, that was the beginning of that person's journey. And I think that one by one, we can change the consumer pressure. And you know, the demand for organic food is at an all-time high. In fact, there's like not enough supply of organic food, at least in the United States. Certainly in underserved communities, there's basically none. So I think that that will be the next step. And our agriculture secretary of the USDA, Tom Vilsack, he recently has made some pretty big announcements in investing in organic agriculture. And he also told an anecdote about how his grandson can't have two doses of dairy like in one sitting. And his dad won't let him do that. And he's like, why is that? Why can't we? I like having, you know, butter and cream on my baked potato, but my grandson can't. And Tom Vilsack is someone that has been very intertwined with big ag and ag chem. And so to hear someone like that starting to talk like that, that makes me think that there have been some personal experiences in his life with, you know, chronic illness that he's starting to realize, okay, wait, maybe this is the food. So I do think activism is worth it in the end. And I think we should do what we can to spread the word, even though it's frustrating day to day a lot of the time.
What's the alternative? I mean, not doing anything about it. I mean, it works. You can see, you know, some of the pressures, at least you're doing. For example, your blog, it's very articulate and very easy to read. So if someone is on a rush can actually read and they can comprehend it very easily. So in my end, I'm also very convoluted about it. But the alternative doesn't sound so good either of not doing anything at all. I think in the long term, it will work. We've seen it work before, obviously. So it does work, although it takes time and courage and a lot of investment in terms of trying to learn how to better communicate whatever you're doing. But I think ultimately you start seeing the results in the end. Yeah.
I think so. And I was really appalled because a few years ago, I was with some old friends and one of their 2-year-old sons had been diagnosed with Crohn's disease at 2 years old. I mean, that is just unheard of. I was like, well, I think, you know, this is kind of stemming from food. And what made me sad is that one of them, the one with Crohn's disease, said, oh, well, I don't want to limit their life. That will make them feel different. And that kind of decision to make on behalf of your child is just so heartbreaking to me. And so my hope is that once again, over the next 5 years, as more knowledge comes around this, like, you know, our kids can get what they need to get better, like heal those guts and not be exposed to, I'm certain that, it, to go back to the beginning, it's so unbelievable, really, that we're all exposed to this quietly poisoned and people don't realize that that's a thing. But we're there.
Yeah, we're definitely almost there. Yeah, the United States is also very complex. And actually, one of the quotes I like from you is that poison is nonpartisan. You know, it's a small little sneak quote, but actually I think it makes sense. So can you sort of elaborate on what actually that quote means?
Yeah, so it's so funny because you see both sides, and particularly you see Democrats and like people have been Democrats their whole life. Like they loved Clinton, they loved Obama, like didn't question anything because if it was from the Democratic Party, it must be like ethically correct. So you see a lot of Democrats presuming that what's being done under any of their administrations must be for the best for health and the environment. That is absolutely not true. So we saw the invention of the GMO seed and the Roundup Ready GMO seed come in under George Bush, first George Bush. When we went to the Clinton administration, the Clintons absolutely loved this idea of this Roundup Ready technology and GMOs. And to this day, they are huge, huge proponents of this chemical agriculture system. It's so damaging. And I still think of the Clinton family as being iconic in terms of the traditional Democratic Party. I think my expectations are just lower for the Republican Party, but you know, then George Bush comes in, continues to perpetuate it. Obama, oh boy, he's talking about GMOs. I think that like things might get better, but they don't. And Michelle Obama came out when they first got to the White House and she said, I'm going to have this organic garden. I'm so excited. And clearly she was very focused on nutrition too for kids. That was her thing. And then suddenly she wasn't able to say that about her organic garden and like was super quieted down. And Obama passed several bills that were incredibly damaging to food transparency while he was in office. We come along and then it's Trump. And I mean, Trump fully deregulated the whole thing and defunded organic agriculture. So you see it happening regardless of which political party is in power. And these companies have such a hold on like all politicians that it truly doesn't seem to make a difference where they fall in line. In fact, where I'm seeing the most interest right now, which is so interesting, the groups that are reaching out to me tend to be super Republican and they really don't like being poisoned. And I think that some of this is along the lines of the same people that really didn't care to have a COVID vaccine. They're like, well, what else is there that, you know, we're being exposed to? Oh my God, we're being slowly poisoned by this. And I don't want to have that on my food. So we should do something about it. So frankly, like, I'm really psyched to see more interest, regardless of how it got there, just to get these pesticides off of our food. But you can't determine by party line who's pro or who's against poisons.
I mean, it should make sense that nobody should want poison in their plate. So it doesn't matter it doesn't matter which party you support. You should just not want poison in your plate. And I do understand the United States is sort of like every decision is binary. It's either you are for or against it. From that point,
it's so weird.
It's like, you know, you can be against poison. That's it.
It'll be interesting to see with the next round of elections who's talking this game. Cory Booker had run for president. He's someone that is a huge advocate for all of this stuff, and he gets it. He understands. And I would love to see him continue in important roles in our government, because I think specifically on this pesticide and soil front, he's our best bet in the government to do some change.
So when you look at, let's say, 5-10 years from now, where do you see glyphosate? Do you think we'll get rid of it? I mean, say like there's no glyphosate at all. What is your crystal ball on that?
So I think that time is about up for glyphosate, and I think that replacements are rapidly coming in. I think that time is up for a few reasons. One, the weeds are becoming resistant to it. So you have these super weeds that are growing on farms that are just, they'll grow whether you spray or not, and they're really tough and resilient. So I love when nature steps in and is like, just stop. Basically, that's what those weeds are doing. I think that other countries aren't going to want our agriculture, simply our corn, our soy, our wheat, because it's sprayed with Roundup. And other countries are taking it more seriously than we are. Like, they don't want to eat that junk. And so that's going to put some market pressure also on what we do. If we can get American consumer to wake up enough, then I think that that will be the final straw for glyphosate. But I am concerned because a new GMO seed came out that's resistant to 5 different pesticides. I mean, it's almost worse. It's just layering them on. None of them are better than glyphosate. You know, they're not coming out with safe alternatives. But hopefully also this financial investment on the part of the government, finally there's money to regenerate. Hopefully a lot of farmers take advantage of those programs.
I mean, the regenerative movement has managed to make the soil look sexy again. It's something that the organic movement has been doing for all this time. For somehow we didn't quite have the right way to communicate the message well, but the regenerative movement has just blown it over the roof.
Yeah, what do you think that is? Is it now it's cool?
Yeah, it's just cool to associate yourself with the soil, but for a long time it was very hard to sell it to people. That shows the power of marketing. It's also interesting. I've also seen Bayer is actually buying some companies that are involved in biological control. But when you look at their statements, they're like, yeah, we believe in the power of biologicals, but it needs to coexist with the kind of chemicals that we are producing. So it's just a typical corporate press release. Yes, we need biologicals, but you know, we also have these products we want to sell, so we're not going to get rid of it. It's just what we would expect from the corporation.
Gosh. It's so crazy. It is really crazy. One of the like epic things that Bayer did is have this private equity arm, and they invested in a company in Palo Alto that is coming up with a gluten that people can tolerate. I mean, I'm just like, no, you are not. You're making us all gluten intolerant, and you're now going to make tons of money of people like me that have to buy the things that I can tolerate. I mean, just sick business plan.
It's
and
crazy.
Then you see that they like, you know, they celebrate themselves so much with their like CSR efforts. And it's like, really, I don't see the responsibility here at all.
Yep, I think this is the perfect segue for us to move into the next segment. And this is what I call the rapid fire questions. So I've prepared some 10 questions for you. I'm going to throw them right to you, and you're just going to throw like some quick answers to the question, and hopefully we'll have some fun. You ready to get started?
I'm ready.
So the first question is, what's the first career you dreamt of having as a kid?
I wanted to be an astronaut, and then I was going to privatize the space. And then Elon Musk stole it from me.
And he should have punted on that idea better. Too bad. So the second question is, if you had to eat one meal going forward, what would you eat?
I would have shoestring French fries that are super salty. And I would have I love little gem lettuce. So I would have little gem lettuce with the super, super ripe tomatoes with it. And that would be the meal that I would want. And I'd feel so happy.
So the third question is, who is your favorite historical figure?
My favorite historical figure has to be Rachel Carson, because she's someone that kicked all this off with her book Silent Spring, and is an activist that really put everything on the line to get information out in the early days of pesticide.
So the fourth question is, what sport do you like to watch or participate in?
My favorite sport is tennis, and I really enjoyed growing up playing that.
The fifth question, if you had any animal in the world as a pet, what would it be and why?
So I really want to have a cow in my lifetime. And I was on the road touring different farms and GMO farms. And one of the farms I visited, they did a big harvest of GMO corn, and then it was turned into feed, and then it was brought over to the animal factory. And so we went over and I saw just this lineup. Oh my God, it was so heartbreaking. Just a lineup of super, super sick cows, like all in a line and just snot coming out of their nose and just so sick and so sad. And I got like eye contact with one of the cows and it was really intense and I just felt so sad for it. And that's the last time I actually ever ate beef. So then I've had an opportunity to work on different rescue farms since then, and they are just big dogs that are so sweet. And so I would love to rescue a cow at some point.
So the sixth question is, what's your favorite beverage, coffee or tea?
I love a black iced tea. I love English breakfast iced tea. That's what I have every single day. That is my choice drink.
So the seventh question is, what's your favorite book?
My favorite book is Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, and it's a beautifully written book. Just the details are so vivid, and just she's such a wonderful author. And so I actually ended up naming my daughter Daphne after the author, Daphne du Maurier.
The eighth question, are you more of an early bird or a night owl?
I try to be early. I really do. But all my best work comes at night. And so when I'm writing at like 11 p.m., that's when my best work comes out. So I guess that I am a night owl, I guess.
So the ninth question, what quote resonates with you most?
So the quote that I always come back to is the Teddy Roosevelt Man in the Arena quote. I just love it so much. And it's, you know, at least if he fails, he fails while daring greatly. And that's something that you and I can both aspire to, I think, because it, as I mentioned, like a lot of times this feels very fruitless, but if we don't try, then who's going to? So dare greatly is very inspiring.
So the last question is, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to your 18-year-old self?
I would advise myself to become a doctor, and I wish that I had become a doctor, and I wanted to be a doctor. And then a local doctor in our community said, no, you don't want to become a doctor because, like, you know, the insurance is like ridiculous. You don't get compensated. The hours are horrible. Patients can be difficult, and totally like changed my track. Just that one person made that big of an impact. And so I didn't become a doctor, and I'm sad that I didn't, because if I had, I would right now be so happily studying functional medicine and sharing all of that. So I wish I'd gone that route.
Well,
but things happen for a reason. So
definitely. I was just about to say that. Well, that was Fern. And thank you very much for agreeing to do this particular segment. I think it's a good way for the listeners to just get a little bit of window into who you are and some of the things that you like. So I always love this segment. And overall, thank you very much for joining me in the podcast. There's a lot of great insights that you've given out. Your story is amazing. Your work is also very much amazing. And you can share with the guys how can they follow your work.
Oh, yeah. So I have my website at glyphosategirl.com. And then I'm on Instagram at Glyphosate Girl. And I'm on Twitter at Glyphosate Girl, but I'm not often posting on there. I'm a little more Instagram.
Again, thank you very much for joining me in the podcast.
All right. Thank you so much.